This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, Senate Homeland Security had a hearing on election fraud. And I understand that these can be sleepy affairs, and I understand the frustration with hearings that amount to a little bit more than speechifying, both from senators as well as those testifying before the committee. But they also do advance the conversation. For example, they give us some fodder to discuss and perhaps clarify some issues. And I thought having Chris Krebs testify, in particular, the former head of the cybersecurity agency, you know, the recently minted 60 Minutes star because he broke bad on Trump and was fired by Trump. I thought it was useful to have him testify because I think there's a distinction that Rand Paul pointed out that turns out to be really important. The most secure election ever, you know, that statement that Chris Krebs made that was expanded beyond its intended scope by Democrats for obvious reasons. Krebs was talking specifically about his lane. Well, what was his lane? Cybersecurity. He's talking specifically about foreign interference and, you know, digital manipulation, computer hacking. And so Rand Paul made that distinction, and Chris Krebs agreed with that distinction.
And the only last comment I would say on what Mr. Krebs, and he can speak for himself, but I think his job was keeping the foreigners out of the election. It was the most secure election based on security of the Internet and technology. But he never has voiced an opinion. He's welcome to today on whether or not dead people voted. I don't think he examined that. Did he examine non-citizens voting? So to say it was the safest election, sure, I agree with your statement if you're referring to foreign intervention. But if you're saying it's the safest election based on no dead people voted, no non-citizens voted, no people broke the absentee rules, I think that's false. And I think that's what's upset a lot of people on our side, is that they're taking your statement to mean, oh, well, there was no problem in the elections. I don't think you examined any of the problems that we've heard here. So really, you're just referring to something differently is what the way I look at it.
And that's exactly what Krebs told the committee. I'm quoting him. Despite some claims, the statement he offered in the open does not address voter fraud, which is not within this group's ambit. Instead, the statement focuses on manipulation or hacking of the machines supporting elections. So again, the most secure election ever was narrowly tailored to his mission as the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. It doesn't contemplate, and he didn't contemplate, signature checks and absentee ballots, and as Rand Paul was referencing, dead people voting or people voting in a with dubious expansion of absentee ballot qualifications and people who were voting who allegedly were non-residents and thus ineligible to vote and so on and so forth.
And you know,
that's an important distinction.
Oh, yeah, because we, you know, no matter the outcome, we all want a secure election, because as you said, if we don't have a secure elections, we don't have a country. And we learned yesterday in Georgia, 1,700 people voted twice, did a mail-in ballot, and then also voted in person. And I want all of those people to get arrested and charged with voter fraud. Because guess what? They have another election already underway in Georgia.
Right. There's about 700,000 ballots that have been cast in the Senate runoffs that are slated for January 5th so far. And now, so remember, just gives you proportional context. About 5 million people voted in Georgia in the presidential race. So, you know, we're a long way to the ultimate turnout. But
yeah, but if they did it the first time, why wouldn't they do it again? You know,
well,
if they got away with it.
700,000 is significant. Something else that's happening in Georgia is, and the Wall Street Journal opined on this yesterday, is that the Secretary of State there, the much-besieged Brad Raffensperger, is doing a absentee ballot signature audit in Cobb County, Georgia. Now that the signature matching has been attacked again and again with no evidence, I feel we need to take steps to restore confidence in our elections. And so he is pursuing that signature check for Cobb County, with the hope that the results will inspire more confidence in the administration of the elections in Georgia. And it speaks to sort of the rejection rate, which we've talked about before. It's odd when you have, in many states, so many more ballots cast by mail than in previous elections and a significantly lower spoilage rate. Now, there may be something to the Wall Street Journal's position that, well, one of the things is you made it easier to mail in the ballots, for example, with these Zuck boxes, as they're called, the drop box boxes.
Yeah.
So perhaps that, and there was more education about properly filling out the ballots and so forth. Perhaps there was also a process in Georgia, in particular, that allowed Georgians to cure errors on their ballots that did not exist in 2016 in the previous presidential election, because it was per a law in 2019 that simplified the absentee ballot process in Georgia. So there are other variables to consider. There's no question, and I'm happy to go wherever the facts lead. But there are still significant questions that remain. And by the way, it is always curious to me when people are run away from questions. They rather than answer the question or make a statement on the merits, give perspective on the merits, they say the whole thing is a sham and we shouldn't even be here and this is more disinformation. Well, a fun moment, finally Ron Johnson got a bit animated. Senator Gary Peters, who was nearly reelected senator from Michigan over John James, and what a tragedy that is. He essentially did that at yesterday's hearing and suggested this thing is a sham and this is misinformation, an opportunity to play out conspiracy theories and so forth. Well, Ron Johnson had just about enough because he has enough institutional memory to recall who has been propagating conspiracy theories over the last 4 years.
I just have to talk about Russian disinformation because the people peddling it are not on my side of the aisle. Senior Democrat leaders, including Ranking Member Peters, were involved in a process of creating a false intelligence product that was supposedly classified. They leaked to the media that accused Senator Grassley, the President Pro Tem of the Senate, and myself of accepting and disseminating Russian disinformation from Andrei Derkach. I'd never heard of the person until they brought it up. Senator Peters introduced that false information, Russian disinformation, into our investigation record. 50 people associated with the intelligence community after our Hunter Biden investigation and the revelations of the Hunter Biden computer said, this is Russian disinformation. Now we find out, it's a real investigation by the Justice Department. So it's just galling, and I just have to point out that the purveyors of Russian disinformation, Hillary Clinton's campaign, the DNC, the Steele dossier, the ranking member Peters accusing Senator Grassley and I of disseminating Russian disinformation, that's where the disinformation is coming. That's where the false information, the lies, the false allegations. And I can't sit by here and listen to this and say that this is not disinformation, this hearing today. This is getting information we have to take a look at to restore confidence in our election integrity. We're not going to be able to just move on without bringing up these irregularities, examining them, and providing an explanation and see where there really are problems so we can correct it moving forward. Senator Paul.
Mr. Chairman, I got to respond to that. I mean, you're saying I'm putting out information. Well, one, I did had nothing to
come
do
on,
with
come on, big
this
guy.
You lied repeatedly.
I did not.
You lied repeatedly in the press that I was spreading Russian disinformation, and that was an outright lie, and I told you to stop lying, and you continue to do it.
Mr. Chairman, this is not about airing your grievances. I don't know what rabbit hole you're running down.
You
right
talked
now.
About
you
Russian disinformation.
Down rabbit holes.
Senator Paul.
This is simply not what we're
Senator
dealing
Paul.
With. But, Mr. Chairman, you can't make these Judge false Starr. Allegations. And then dropping it there. That is why this
Senator
committee
Paul.
Needs to return back
Good
to
star,
it.
Senator
Paul. Partisan things. This is terrible what you're doing to this committee and all the great work that you talked about.
It is what you have done to this committee.
It is not
falsely accusing the chairman of spreading disinformation.
Yeah, that's right, and it's about time Ron Johnson, who's a pretty reasonable guy, maybe he's not always as aggressive as some would like him to be, but right, he's a reasonable
was yesterday.
Guy. He's a thoughtful guy. He's a serious guy, a successful businessman. He comes to the Senate with sort of a small-C conservative common-sense perspective, sort of like Mike Braun in Indiana. And, it's about time that there is some – really digging in with respect to holding Democrats accountable for the promulgation of conspiracy theories with respect to Russia right up until today, right up until yesterday, right up until the Hunter Biden story, the Hunter Biden investigation, of course, which turns out to be a real thing, not Russian disinformation. That there has to be a reckoning. And so while we're waiting, and perhaps this will be a waiting for Godot exercise, but while we're waiting for a legal reckoning, there is no reason why there shouldn't be a continuous, relentless, rhetorical reckoning for what hacks and conspiracy theorists and professional liars like Michigan's Gary Peters actually did, documented, not in controversy if you look at the record, over the last 3 years. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And to Ron Johnson's point about looking at specific things, there was specific testimony. It would have been helpful if some of what was presented at the hearing was fully investigated and properly litigated. One of Trump's attorneys for his team in Wisconsin said that there were several problems in Wisconsin. 17,271 ballots were received through improper and illegal means, unsupervised, in violation of Wisconsin election law, according to this attorney. He said, look, 3 million people properly voted in Wisconsin. More than 200,000 did not. But those votes got counted, and our statute said they shouldn't have been, and that tainted the Wisconsin election. He said some mail-in voters were identified who identified themselves as permanently confined, unable to leave their homes. Mm-hmm. However, it included poll workers and an elector for Biden in the Electoral College. So fraudulent. This expansion of indefinitely confined to be sort of whatever I say indefinitely confined is. And it still sort of baffles me why there wasn't a real zeroing in on that cohort of ballots.
And he lost by 20,000.
in Wisconsin. He also said there were 28,395 people explicitly identified who were allowed to vote without identification and who were improperly, under the previous understanding of what indefinitely confined meant in Wisconsin, were not eligible under that previous definition.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Another specific example, Jesse Banal, we've talked about before, part of Trump's legal team in Nevada, said that there were 42,000 people who voted more than once.
Yep.
Which Banal said the legal team determined by reviewing the list of actual voters and comparing them to other voters with the same name, address, and date of birth. At least 1,500 people dead are recorded as having voted as well, as shown by comparing the list of male voters with the Social Security death records. He also said more than 19,000 people voted in Nevada despite not living in the state, noting that number did not include students or military voters. 8,000 people voted from non-existent addresses. More than 15,000 votes were cast from commercial or vacant addresses, he said. He also said about 4,000 non-citizens voted. Again,
and all of that adds up, and Trump probably would have won.
Well, I mean, that's
easily.
If you add all those numbers, it's right. Clearly more than the difference in Nevada. But here's the thing. If you have the documentation to support those contentions and those specific numbers, how this was not more effectively litigated in Nevada is a bit baffling.
Well, it was the time. I mean, I told you my aunt, she took mail-in ballots and volunteered and went with other people to these addresses on these mail-in ballots. It brought them to vacant lots, casinos, motels, hotels, resorts. I mean, people just put down any address that they wanted, and it was never checked, and their vote counted. And that is wrong. That is something that needs to be focused on for the next election, and they got to clean the voter rolls.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and before we turn our attention to Hunter Biden and his upcoming art show, which I know you want the details
on. Oh, yes.
We're talking about the Senate Homeland Security hearing yesterday on voter fraud on the 2020 election. And Mike in Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hi, Dan, Amy. I'd just like to say voter fraud is treason, and whoever did it should be found, caught, tried, and executed.
Okay.
Well, that's a little aggressive, but
I don't think it's a capital crime in most states, but I appreciate the intensity of support for election integrity.
Well, I mean, just real quick, back to Georgia, those 1,700 who voted twice, the majority of the double voters, Dan, were Democrats who cast an absentee ballot either by mail or drop box, and then they also voted in person. And guess what? The highest share of offenders were from Fulton County, which includes Atlanta. And their votes were still counted twice, and nobody's been arrested so far. And they should go after them because they know who they are, and they should, you know, set an example. Like, this is a fraud. I mean, this is voter fraud, and it's a felony under state law. They should send that strong message.
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking the call. I'll tell you what, you talk about the most disgusting thing that comes out of, like, these are hearings where they're under oath, and these leftists, rotten people and everything like that. You're talking about the Krebs. You're talking about the Peters. You're talking about that CEO of Dominion the other day. They lie through their teeth. They don't. They're arrogant. They could care less about even being under oath. They are the solid liars. They lie about everything and everything like that. What can you do with people where you, when you put them under oath at a hearing and they still lie like that?
Well, thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, you could do what was attempted, not more than attempted, with respect to, I don't know, people like George Papadopoulos, is you could prosecute them for perjury. I mean, you could do that. I mean, there's a Durham investigation pending. I mean, I know that with Papadopoulos it was lying to the FBI, but it's the same sort of concept. We know that, for example, James Comey and Andy McCabe made statements that are mutually exclusive in terms of one has to be true and one has to be false, both statements made under oath. Will either of them be prosecuted for perjury? I'm not holding my breath. Carl, on the south side.
Dan, I like everything you say, but I'm taking issue this morning with your pronunciation of the word hearing. It's pronounced dog and pony show.
No, nah, got that wrong. Got it.
We officially live, I'll get to you, Amy. Oh, we officially live in a bananic republic of socialistic ideas. As AOC would say, and the squad, shut your mouth, get back in line, and wait for your piece of cake, unless we run out before we get there. And Amy,
yes,
now that we're in a socialist society, we're going to be like Venezuela, the utopian, where we eat our pets, not feed them.
All right.
Why do you think I'm fattening up Bunky, huh, for the kill?
Sure. Yeah, hold Bunky out in reserve. It's good to stockpile with French bulldogs, I guess. But it's French. Bunky's
no,
French
English.
Bulldog.
Come
oh,
on.
English bulldog.
English, more refined. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know either. I think the French bulldogs are actually cuter. Not that either one is a particularly good-looking dog, but...
Oh, no one can be as good-looking as Hayek, is that what you're saying? You're a Arubian Kukutuku? What kind of dog?
Arubian Kanuku. I mean, he's a matinee idol. I mean, this is like in the category of Lassie.
Oh.
You know, it's not even worth talking about.
He is light on his feet, though. He's fast. Ooh, he can run like the wind.
Well, I guess if we're going to live in a banana republic, then we might as well enjoy our bread and circuses. And I got one for you coming up. This is exciting news. No, you know, and it's great, really, because, you know, it's
a story about second chances.
Well, it reminds me of Shawshank Redemption. You know, there's something that people can't get to, even though you're behind bars. There's something that hope, you know, the soaring music from Marriage of Figaro in the yard when he plays, right? And it says, you know, they can't get there. And with Hunter Biden, the there is, no matter what, you know, bad people like you and me do to Hunter Biden, he will always have his art. And that's fantastic. Page 6, New York Post reporting that Hunter Biden has inked a deal to be represented by a New York gallery, and an announcement and exhibition of Hunter Biden's art is being planned for next year.
What?
We don't have the dates yet, but obviously we will confer those when they are. And if New York City is still shut down, you can be sure, much like they make an exception for protesting for the right causes.
Right. And for Hollywood elites, yes.
Yeah, there'll be an exception for Hunter Biden's art.
Because it's art.
Hunter Biden revealed earlier this year how his art, and you're thinking, well, what is the nature of Hunter Biden's art? Great question. I'm glad you asked.
Yeah, what is it?
He makes blown ink abstractions on paper.
That's not art. That pen exploded. Wait, what do you mean? Have you seen some of his work?
I have not seen his work.
I mean, this
I'm
the
anxious
build-up
to see
is
it.
Going to be great.
Yeah, blown ink.
Blown art. Well, didn't you blow something once? Oh, you blew glass in Los Cabos, right?
Yeah, I blew bubbles, and now bubbles won't stop calling. Blown ink abstractions on paper.
I'm going to Google images.
I don't know if blow and Hunter Biden, if that's helpful to him that they're in the same sentence, even if it relates to art. But here's Hunter Biden talking about his art. For years, I wouldn't call myself an artist. Now I feel comfortable saying it. So Hunter Biden is many things.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, he is an international businessman. He is also an artist. Painting, he said, puts my energy towards something positive. It keeps me away from people and places where I shouldn't be.
Such as China and Ukraine.
He didn't say that specifically, but I tell you what, if it keeps him away from compromising America's national security and selling it to the highest bidder among our enemies, then I would encourage Hunter Biden to blow as much art as he'd like.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Working from a studio, I mean, more color here, I know you're
please.
Interested. Working from a studio in a pool house in the Hollywood Hills, he uses a metal straw to blow alcohol ink onto Japanese Yupo paper.
You cannot be around alcohol at all. You can't even use Listerine with alcohol in it if you're a recovering alcoholic.
He's blowing alcohol ink.
I know, but
he's not ingesting it.
Well, it's near his mouth, and I don't like it.
Well, we all have gone through our alcohol ink on Japanese Yupo paper phase, so let him have his time. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to. Are there any famous artists that blow ink that we know of?
That is not in the sort of in the pantheon of art. That is not my area of expertise.
I mean,
maybe this, you know, he's sort of a this is something in sort of the Jackson Pollock area, perhaps. I mean, not exactly, of course, but I don't know. And again, I mean, this is, you know,
I mean, how much do you think his pieces are going to go for?
Well,
tens of thousands of dollars just because he's a Biden, because they want access to his father. Do you see what I'm doing here?
Well, how much ever Chinese energy companies would like to pay to adorn their corporate offices with Hunter Biden's art, of course.
Right.
But it's your grandson, huh? Oh, wonderful boy. Nice boy. That is a good boy, I'll tell you. Now I know why tigers eat their young, you know?
Yeah, that's Hunter Biden, no question about it. On that note of the Chinese energy company.
Yes.
Fox News obtaining another email that Hunter Biden sent to the chairman of CEFC. This is the Chinese energy company that was supposed to set aside 10% of this deal they were working out for the big guy. This is the Chinese energy company that was going to be run, at least from the Hunter Biden side, by Tony Bobulinski, who gave that interview to Tucker Carlson, laying it all out. So in this email, Hunter Biden, I hope my letter finds you well. I regret missing you on your last visit to the United States. This to Chairman Yi of CEFC. June 17, 2017. Please accept the best wishes from the entire Biden family, as well as
nice.
My partners.
Yeah. Pleasantries, yes.
I think Joe Biden put a smiley emoji on the email for his contribution. We are all hoping to see you here again soon or in Shanghai. He continued to note that Bobulinski had sent a request to Gongwen Dong and Director Zhang for the funding of a $10 million wire. I would appreciate if you will send that quickly so we can properly fund and operate at Sinohawk, which was this joint venture between Team Biden and Team Chinese Communists. I'm sure you've been briefed by our dear friend, Director Zhang, on the political and economic connections we have established in countries where you are interested in expanding in the coming months and years. I look forward to our next meeting. Yeah.
Okay.
So, it's all very interesting, particularly now that we know an investigation has been afoot for the better part of 2 years and may include the big guy. I know we're supposed to say, well, there's no allegations of wrongdoing. Well, there is a criminal investigation. Well, there's been no assertion that Joe Biden was in any way involved, and he has denied involvement or knowledge of any of Hunter Biden's dealings. Well, yeah, but there seems to be a lot of evidence, including from Hunter Biden's own mouth, that the big guy was involved and had some idea what was going on and was meaningfully participating in things like meetings with Tony Bobulinski to talk about the Sinohawk joint venture, as Tony Bobulinski provided in detail their sit down in LA. But okay. All right. I know that the DC press corps says there's nothing to see here. And to the extent you think there's something to see here, we're going to block you from seeing it on social media. Okay. All right. John in Evanston, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. This is too early in the morning for this. The second I heard you say that he's now an artist.
He's an artist.
Exactly, but he's the same thing as Bill Clinton giving $400,000 speeches, who hasn't given a speech since Hillary was out of office. This is now the way that everybody gets to Big Daddy Joe. They buy a piece of paper with his spittle on it for $6 million. It's a perfect way to wash money.
Well, it's true. A blown art, thanks for the call, John, starts going for,
going to be exorbitant. I mean, it's going to be thousands of dollars. I'm not
tens of that. Well, I mean, if it starts to exceed Girl Before a Mirror, something Picasso offered, if it starts to exceed then perhaps there is some question. If it's like, I'll give you, $500 for it and pat him on the head. Well, maybe not. But is that a possible avenue? I can't wait to. I mean, I'm actually anxious for the exhibition because I want to see the art, number one, and I want to see who buys it and for what price. I think it would be fascinating.
Yep, you're right. How much do you think George Soros is going to buy some?
Right, Pete and Racine.
I bet the Obamas will.
Hearing that Hunter Biden is an artist has now changed my adolescent mind as to the great artist Raquel Welch that used to roll and paint naked, then roll on canvas. That has now been ruined.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is art. Thanks for the call, Pete. That's the difference. That is, marketable, I would say. Brad in West Loop.
Yeah, you were wondering what else blows ink. So octopus and squid, they release ink to escape from predators.
Oh.
And Hunter's he's a mystery man. You never know where he is because they're always looking for Hunter. So I think henceforth we should refer to him as the International Squid of Mystery.
That's not bad.
That's good.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Brad. I was going to go with crack pop.
Like corn pop, crack pop.
Yeah, but, squid and the whole, analogy. Yeah, that's not bad. Lewis on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Hold my beer. Hunter Biden.
Already?
No, it's my turn. Okay. This is my turn. Hold my beer. I'm going in. Okay. Hunter Biden is an artist. Hunter Biden is a con artist.
There you go. Thanks for the
Thank
call,
you.
Lewis. By the way, just in terms of other perhaps patrons of Hunter Biden's art, Facebook and Twitter executives poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into Joe Biden's presidential campaign. At the same time, they were blocking the New York Post expose on Hunter Biden's overseas business dealings. And a good story by the New York Post, Facebook's VP of Public Policy and Chief Privacy Officer donated $100,000 to Democrats and Biden in the final weeks.
If you work for the media, you should not be allowed to donate money to a campaign. Sorry.
Well, you're still an American.
I know, but
if you want to, if you want to call your objectivity into question, that's fine. It doesn't bother me. And, you know, in point of fact, I rather prefer it. It's like the journalists who say, well, I don't vote in primaries because I don't want to give the impression that I'm anything less than objective. We already know you're something less than objective because you're a human being. So the idea that you're not being trans, you're not doing things that would indicate your actual perspective makes you objective. That is not the definition of objectivity or the definition of somebody interested in fair play. That's just the definition of somebody who doesn't want you to know what their actual perspective is. That's not the same thing.
Yeah,
so go ahead and donate. Go ahead and vote in primaries. I just prefer you lay it out because then that actually informs how we should consume your work product, doesn't it?
Right. But I mean, I've worked in, what, 7 states, and always you had one anchor who donated money to a Democratic candidate. Like, I think his name was Rich Fisher. I can't even remember the amount. But then he had to take it back. You know, they had to write him a check back because he didn't want to look. You know, the news director said, you can't do that because that shows that you're biased and you're supposed to be covering the news, not promoting your agenda.
Yeah, but
still they do it.
Yeah, but the whole point is that is a charade.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So go ahead. Be yourself.
Be yourself.
Don't hide from us. Go ahead and make a donation to whoever you feel compelled to make a donation to. Go ahead and vote in whatever primary you want to vote in because it's instructive. And I'd rather be informed than, you know, than lied to. Jim in Crown Point.
You know, once again, the press messed this up. Hunter Biden said he has blown art. A claim which Art has vehemently denied.
Hi-oh. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is a full-blown 4-alarm holiday emergency here.
On AM 560.
We're going to have the happiest Christmas since Bing Crosby tap dance with Danny f***ing K.
The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. To paraphrase Kentucky Fried Movie, there's COVID in your Coca-Cola film at 11.
That was a great tease. You had me. You had me at COVID in my Coca-Cola.
A member of Austria's parliament demonstrated the defectiveness of the Austrian government's COVID-19 antigen test by showing how a glass of Coca-Cola yields a positive test. In footage from the parliamentary meeting, the general secretary of one of the parliamentary parties there brings a glass of cola to the podium from which he proceeds to collect drops to use on an antigen rapid test being used on a mass scale. After going to the lectern and starting his speech, he sprinkles the COVID rapid test with a few drops of Coke. 3 minutes later, the test showed a result, positive.
What?
And then he went on to, of course, say, we have a problem here. We have a positive corona test in Parliament, namely this cola triggered a positive corona test. I don't know how to deal with it now. With things like this, you are throwing tens of millions of euros in tax money out the window instead of providing real protection for old people and nursing homes, instead of investing money in our hospitals. He goes on to complain about the infringement of people's rights in Austria. Today I did a corona test live in Parliament. The corona mass tests are worthless. This was also shown by a simple experiment in Parliament in which cola had a positive test. But this government spends tens of millions in tax money on precisely these tests. Another Australian politician dismissed his claims and accused of being drunk.
You're hammered, man.
I had the whole time hoped this was not a cola, but Bacardi cola that would have justified your behavior a bit, and then to which he responded by holding up a can of Coke. So, look, I don't know. I'm watching it right now.
Wow.
I don't know the particulars of this test, the antigen test that Austria has been using, but it is sort of a dramatic demonstration of
the silliness that's going around, not in just America, but around the world.
Oh, yeah. Maybe? And what we think is beyond reproach and what might not be. Now, again,
I mean, it's not a pointless demonstration, really.
No.
And it reminds me of what Elon Musk did. He sat down with the same nurse, the same setting, didn't touch anything, took 4 saliva antigen tests, 2 came back negative, 2 came back positive.
Now, it is worth noting, I think, what was it, 93% of the testing that's been done has come back negative. So, you know, the inaccuracies can go in both directions. And I don't know, I don't really have a handle on what the margin of error is as these tests continue to be advanced and new antigen tests in particular come on the market. In point of fact, yesterday, Abbott received emergency use authorization from the FDA to use their $5 paper strip rapid antigen test at home. There is a catch. Mm. The catch to the $5 antigen test is it requires a prescription and will cost an additional $25 for a digital MD service to have someone watch you use it. So, but it's still, you know, arguably, and this is Michael Mina, who's an epidemiologist at Harvard, tweeting about this. It's still it's being hailed as a massive step forward. As you know, we have improved therapeutics, we've improved testing, and obviously we have vaccines on the market now. So, what's happening in Austria isn't necessarily happening in America, and where we were in April isn't where we are in December. I don't want to be over the top on it, but I also just want to bring this sort of sensational story to the fore for the purposes of reminding us to be humble about what we don't know.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Particularly so when Tony Fauci is saying, no Christmas for you. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, what will you be doing for Christmas if you gathered for Thanksgiving, much to the chagrin of the lockdowners? Will you now abide their admonition to isolate for Christmas?
I mean, it's hard because, you know, you don't want to kill grandma or grandpa or even get them sick. So just out of an abundance of caution, you know, we changed our Thanksgiving.
There's that phrase.
Yeah, an abundance of caution. Mom is going to be with her friends for Thanksgiving in Tucson and not fly up here like she was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know. I don't know if that's the right thing. You know, I mean, everyone's got their own opinion, it's their own choice, but my mom's going through some health issues right now. So because of that, that's why I told her, and the sisters all agreed, you've got to stay home. So she's hanging out with her friends, and she has more friends than I do. But they're all old, and they've been, excuse me, hanging out this whole time anyway.
With respect to Tony Fauci, there's a new research paper out that's quite interesting. It's the author is Ronald Brown of Waterloo University. It appears in the journal Disaster Medicine and Public Health Preparedness, which is a real page-turner. If you haven't subscribed, you should.
Can you put it back on my desk, please?
Public health lessons learned from biases in coronavirus mortality overestimation is the title of his paper. It also appears on the website of the National Institute of Health from actually back in the fall. Brought to my attention by Jeffrey Tucker over at American Institute for Economic Research. And there's a real focus on a seminal moment in this whole 2020 COVID-19 saga. It is testimony from Tony Fauci on, March 11th of this year. This testimony, where he made the dramatic pronouncement that COVID was 10 times more fatal than the flu.
SARS was also a coronavirus in 2002. It infected 8,000 people, and it killed about 775. It had a mortality of about 9 to 10%. So that's only 8,000 people. In about a year, in the 2.5 months that we've had this coronavirus, as you know, we now have multiples of that. So it clearly is not as lethal, and I'll get to the lethality in a moment, but it certainly spreads better. Probably for the practical understanding of the American people, the seasonal flu that we deal with every year has a mortality of 0.1%. The stated mortality overall of this, when you look at all the data, including China, is about 3%. It first started off as 2 and now 3. I think if you count all the cases of minimally symptomatic or asymptomatic infection, that probably brings the mortality rate down to somewhere around 1%, which means it is 10 times more lethal than the seasonal flu. I think that's something that people can get their arms around and understand.
But less lethal than N1H1 or SARS?
No, absolutely not. H1N1 is even, the 2009 pandemic of H1N1 was even less lethal than the regular seasonal flu. It was a pandemic.
I'm trying to help the American people know where to appropriately set their gauge.
I think you set the gauge is that this is a really serious problem that we have to take seriously. I mean, people always say, well, the flu, you know, the flu does this, the flu does that. The flu has a mortality of 0.1%.
Sure.
This has a mortality of 10 times that.
Okay.
And that's the reason why I want to emphasize we have to stay ahead of the game in preventing this.
Mm-hmm. The decimal point that destroyed the world is how Jeffrey Tucker describes it. Mm-hmm. Here's Brown from Waterloo University in his paper. Sampling bias in coronavirus mortality calculations led to a tenfold increased mortality overestimation in that testimony you just heard. This bias most likely followed from information bias due to misclassifying a seasonal influenza infection fatality rate as a case fatality rate. Infection fatality rate, case fatality rate, which was evident in a New England Journal of Medicine editorial. Evidence from the WHO confirmed that the approximate case fatality rate of COVID is generally no higher than that of seasonal influenza. By early May of this year, mortality levels from COVID were considerably below predicted overestimations, a result that the public attributed to successful mitigating measures to contain the spread of the novel virus. And he walks you through the difference between infection fatality rate and case fatality rate and overall mortality rate. I know this is a bit, you know, maybe a bit complicated. I don't think it's actually that complicated. Infection fatality rate from samples across the population include undiagnosed, asymptomatic, and mild infections. To calculate the IFR, you do randomized samples to judge prevalence. The results are inclusive of cases, what we used to call sick people. But to extend people who merely carry traces of the dead virus but are in no substantial danger of passing onward or experiencing any severe outcomes. Cases, on the other hand, are based exclusively on relatively smaller groups of moderately to severe ill-diagnosed cases at the beginning of the outbreak. The case fatality rate is a smaller group than the infection fatality rate, right? Case fatality measures severity. Infection fatality measures prevalence. And so if you're going to compare how severe a pandemic is, you have to compare apples to apples. And what Tony Fauci did in that March 11th testimony was compare apples to oranges and essentially compare infection fatality rate to case fatality rate. February 28th, Tony Fauci is the co-author, New England Journal of Medicine. The overall clinical consequences of COVID-19 may ultimately be more akin to those of a severe seasonal influenza or a pandemic influenza rather than a disease similar to SARS and MERS. As Tucker writes, what matters here is not the prediction as such, but the switching of the word infection with case. The flu has a case fatality rate of 0.1%. This was incorrect even at the time of writing. You can call it a misprint or sloppy or downright duplicitous. Regardless, even the World Health Organization had identified the 0.1% figure as the flu's infection fatality rate. Flu's infection fatality rate is 0.1%, not its case fatality rate.
Oh, I see.
Fauci's article directly contradicted the WHO, ran counter to everything that was already known. But his CFR claim about the flu confusing it with the IFR, is precisely what led him to claim in front of Congress that COVID would defy all experiences of this generation, would be 10 times worse than the flu, which is the top line that everybody took and ran with. So this is important because that pronouncement opened the floodgates to all of the lockdown policies, to all of the things that are unprecedented, like quarantining healthy people. An invitation to misclassification. People would other is that followed. Additionally, people otherwise would have been previously classified as having heart disease or some other comorbidity could not be classified as COVID. Because they, what do? They, something else unprecedented. Probable or likely deaths were COVID deaths, right?
Right.
Following Tucker giving us more on the timeline, following the March 11th Fauci testimony, in which he conflated infection fatality and case fatality, the whole thing blew up. Business Insider in June. The coronavirus death rate in the U.S. is almost 50 times higher than that of the flu. See how they compare by age bracket. But if you look carefully at the charts, you can see something fishy. They calculated infection fatality rate for flu against the case fatality rate for COVID. The infection fatality rate is lower than the case fatality rate. So you're comparing apples to oranges. And it generates a wild overestimate of four COVID deaths. Yes, their charts were terrifying at the time, and so are the pronouncements that are still being made to this day. But they're also not based in reality because you're not offering the comparison that is appropriate to understand the scope of the threat.
And now, excuse me, now our lives have completely changed. We don't know when we're going to get them back. It's frustrating.
And what do we have right now? And by the way, Tucker makes the point as well, which is a good one. You know, in that testimony, it was all in addition to conflating case fatality rate with infection fatality rate and comparing apples to oranges, flu versus COVID on those two metrics. It was all about fatality rates. There was never any presentation using the phrase survival rate. The survival rate by age, just to repeat, 99.997, 0 to 19, 99.98, 20 to 49, 99.5, 50 to 69, 94.6, 70 plus. John Ioannidis, Stanford epidemiologist, sums up the disparity by age with the following infection fatality rate for people under the age of 70. Under the age of 70, overall, the fatality rate is 0.05%. The infection fatality rate, 0.05%, with an infection fatality rate of the flu, we don't really know. We don't really know because there's no age-specific IFR on the seasonal flu. So what that means is that crucial testimony from Fauci on March 11th, in which he casually predicted based on bad numbers COVID would be 10 times worse than the flu, can neither be confirmed or denied based on age-specific severe outcomes. We don't know. He didn't know then. We still don't know now. I mean, it's just I don't know what to say about it other than to try to break it down the same way that Jeffrey Tucker did over at the American Institute for Economic Research, the same way that this Robert Brown from Waterloo University did. But we're going to look back on this, some of us at least, maybe. Some of us will just sort of quickly shuffle along pretending that we weren't part of this, perhaps, or pretending that we are not acknowledging what we know to be true, even in real time. But, I mean, this isn't even – these things are not part of the conversation. Nobody will entertain anything other than the orthodoxy. You're just running headlong off a cliff with the other lemmings.
Someone said to me the other day, oh, I can't wait till someday we laugh about this. I said, I will never laugh about this.
What's funny about this?
That's what I said. What is funny about it? But it's a different experience for everybody. Your experience is completely different than a mom with five kids who has to homeschool. And so it's different for everybody. And this woman, you know, she doesn't have kids. Or no, her kids are older and, you know, they're working and it just doesn't affect them. I said, well, can you imagine, like, put yourself in other people's shoes? This is not funny at all. Our kids' lives are being destroyed years they can't get back.
Well, it's not funny on a couple of levels. I mean, one, obviously, the virus is a serious thing, and right. people have gotten sick and died, and that's not funny. And two, so much of this policy response, unprecedented policy response, has been a fraud. How else do you describe it? At minimum, power if you want to be generous, has been based on no science or false science, which is to say, you know, a science. It's been based on politics, not science and data, while we're being relentlessly pelted with science and data, science and data, science and data, shamed were we to ask any questions about the science and data that's referenced in vague generalities by politicians. And then you have this breakdown. So it's sort of like with mask wearing. You know, to tell me this is all wrong, fine. I'm not tethered to any particular position. You're trying to suss this out. And, oh, by the way, the TV doctors and the TV politicians aren't helping very much. But so tell me that Professor Brown's paper is all wet. Tell me that Tony Fauci's testimony on March 11th was spot on. Tell me that the Mount Sinai and the Danish studies, and there's now a new study on mask wearing that just came out yesterday. Tell me that that's all a bunch of nonsense and break it down for me. I'm happy to listen. Why aren't you? Why aren't those that speak of COVID-19 with metaphysical certitude, why aren't you happy to listen? Why won't you entertain questions? Why won't you break anything down? I will. Cameron in Australia?
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, good day. How's it going?
Good. Good day.
Thanks for calling in.
Never been able to say that on this show before. All right, go ahead, Cameron.
I called in before.
Yeah,
we're doing pretty well with our coronavirus here. We did do lockdowns and mask mandates and things like that. We had 17 cases in New South Wales just recently in the Northern Beaches. And they're considering closing borders again to Queensland to stop the spread. They do work. We haven't had the mass graves that they had in New York and places like that. We haven't had ICU capacity overburdened. We did manage to flatten the curve. We've had less than 1,000 people die, even though we had more cases than the US did at the start of this whole pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think you should listen to Fauci. If you look
listening
at the US, you've already...
I'm just asking questions about what he says. I'm not listening to him and taking him as like he's delivering tablets to me from on high. That's the only that's the difference.
No, but I mean, if you consider, if the whole US population had COVID, run the course of the disease, you've already got almost 0.01% of the population who have died from this thing. Mm-hmm. So when you look at how many people are dying on a daily basis, it's, you know, 3,500 people almost yesterday. You know.
Yeah, but normally in the United States, 7,000 to 8,000 people die a day in the United States before COVID
yes,
even happened.
This is excess deaths. This is more than the norm.
There's not excess deaths.
There is. If you actually look at the statistics,
yeah, we've talked about
the
that.
And, death rate.
Yeah, I know. Thanks for the call, Cameron. We're up against the news. We've talked about that, and we've asked questions about excess deaths too. Just on the hospitalization issue, I mean, is anything they tell us straight away? Andrew Bostrom, who's an assistant assistant professor of medicine at Brown University, he posted this. Estimated national hospitalization use. Inpatient beds occupied, all patients, at 74% capacity right now, 74% of capacity. Inpatient beds occupied for COVID-19 patients, 15% of that. 15% of our national capacity is COVID patients, 74% overall occupied. ICU beds occupied, all patients, at 64% right now. So that the again, the health system is being overwhelmed. The health system is being overwhelmed. Well, that data suggests that's not true. So, again, tell me the data's wrong. No problem. I'm happy to listen. Break it down for me. But don't tell me just to accept what somebody says because somebody says it who has a credential or who has a post or who's on TV. I just won't do it.
Math doesn't lie.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get to the case of Anjanette Young, which we began talking about yesterday. But just one point for our friend Cameron from Australia who called. He was talking about the success that Australia is having in combating COVID. Yeah. Just understand that Melbourne endured more than 100 days under one of the most stringent lockdowns in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Victoria's premier, this guy Daniel Andrews, who served as sort of the COVID czar, they were doing things like you were not allowed to go outside. You were not allowed to travel more than 15 miles from your home.
Oh, yeah.
You had a 2-hour time limit for exercising outdoors and so on and so forth.
Yeah, they have police out there checking people and checking their papers. It's crazy. Who wanted to live like that?
Yeah, you're right. And so Australia doesn't have our constitution. Even though, it's a free country. It's a civilized Western country. I get it. But does not have our constitution and our constitutional protections, number one. Number two, here's the thing with those who stick to the lockdown policy despite its demonstrated ineffectualness in my estimation and the estimation of a lot of others, too. Look where we're at 10 months after the first lockdowns. Here's the thing. What are you willing to do? Yes, you can slow the spread if you seal people inside their homes like they did in Wuhan. But tell me exactly how far you're willing to go and for how long before you tell me about how you wonderfully reduced the spread for a period of time until you started to relax the restrictions and then you see another outbreak, just as we've seen here. It's not so easy as the lockdowners make it seem. Tell me how far you're willing to go and for how long before you tell me about how effective lockdown policies are, when, in point of fact, we've seen that the lockdown policies put you on a merry-go-round. They're not dispositive of the issue. So with respect to Australia, and I hope it works out for them, just like I hope it works out for every country. I don't want anybody in the world to get COVID. And I don't want anybody in any country in the world to be beset by COVID, okay? But don't tell me it's over anywhere. We've had those pronouncements before, too. I go back to something Johan Gasecki, the former state epidemiologist from Sweden, said at the outset of this. You know, talk to me in a year, and let's see where everybody's at. So, that's this spring. Yeah, maybe it's talk to me in 2 years and let's see where everybody's at before we start making definitive pronouncements. But we have to make judgments based on imperfect information in real time, and that's what we're trying to do, that balance. Okay. With respect to the Anjanette Young case, this is the woman 2 years ago now who had her door busted down and nine Chicago police officers busting in. They had a warrant. Because they got a tip from a confidential informant that there was a convicted felon with a gun posing a immediate threat to public safety. Problem is, they got the wrong house. They busted in on Anjanette Young, who's a social worker, when she was getting undressed from work and dressed. She's naked. The body cam video is very difficult to watch. It's terrible how, have to feel for Anjanette Young. It's just a terrible thing that she experienced. And she tried to communicate for 20 minutes before Chicago police finally sort of wondered, maybe she's right. This is Anjanette Young imploring Chicago police that they have the wrong house. She is not a convicted felon. She does not have a gun. She is a social worker.
We count it. She says it at least 43 times.
You got the wrong house!
And she was right. They were in the wrong house. Our investigation uncovered police failed to do the most basic research before getting the search warrant approved. We found they simply took the word of an informant who gave them Anjanette Young's address. The informant claimed a 23-year-old man who was a known felon had a gun and ammo inside.
I don't know who that person is. I've been living here for 4 years and nobody lives here but me.
Okay.
Okay, you have the shelf. I don't have the shelf. This is f***ing ridiculous. You got me in handcuffs, I'm naked, you've kicked my house in, and I keep telling you, you got the wrong place.
Dave Savini, CBS reporting, and he also reported how easy it would have been to get the right address of the guy that they were actually looking for.
So where was the target? Our investigation revealed he was awaiting trial on home confinement here at a different apartment in Anjanette. Would it have been to locate him? Easy. Real easy. Because he was wearing a police tracking device.
So he was in the same apartment complex as Anjanette?
Right next door.
Right next
yes.
door.
Mm-hmm.
And Mayor Lightfoot came out yesterday. You know, she's just, you know, this happened before she was mayor, but still, she feels bad for Anjanette.
I am deeply sorry and troubled that her home was invaded and that she had to face the humiliation and trauma that she suffered. That is just not right. It simply should not have happened.
Yeah, well, obviously. I mean, the moral indignation Lori Lightfoot is wearing a bit thin these days. But of course, it shouldn't have happened. The police on the scene acknowledged their mistake, tried to fix her door on the way out. So the police made a mistake, and it's a terrible one. And there needs to be accountability for that. And the problem I have, in addition to feeling terrible for what happened to Anjanette Young, which is obvious, is that you're going to have police department make mistakes. You're going to have any organization with 12, 13,000 people interacting with the public make mistakes. There are going to be people that make bad judgment calls, don't do the sort of due diligence they should,
right.
and it could lead to catastrophic results, which is why due diligence is so important.
She's lucky she didn't get shot.
Well, I mean, she also was perfectly compliant with police, so there's a lesson there, too. The police got it wrong, but she didn't escalate things by doing something stupid. She just tried to implore them that they were mistaken, and she was right.
And she lawyered up yesterday.
Well, of course she did. But the problem here is, why are we talking about this case only because against the objections of the city? Oh, by the way, Lori Lightfoot, your legal department, this body cam video was finally released. CBS News reporting this, and good for them for reporting it. And it's taken 2 years. This should have been a case where the city moved to proactively resolve the wrong that was committed on Anjanette Young with Anjanette Young. And that's why she wasn't really in the mood for Lori Lightfoot's moral indignation.
I was there when you came to my church and you campaigned. And I was all on board for voting for you, and I did vote for you. Mm-hmm. I told my friends to vote for you.
Wow.
I believed in you as a black woman that was running for mayor in the city of Chicago.
Yes, yes.
So I want you to come back to my church,
yes.
And I want you to respond to this.
Yes.
Because that's where you asked me to vote for you. So come back and tell me and the people at my church how you're going to fix this. Mm-hmm. So that this never happens again to me or anyone else. It's not okay.
It's not okay. And again, there's going to be mistakes made by police officers, so something like that could happen again. But there's two things. One is, so is there a way to make sure that there's no confusion about things like, do I have the address
the right
before I'm about to bust in and, you know, ramshackle the place?
And maybe not, you know, don't put all of the eggs in one basket for the informant.
Well,
yeah,
that's the whole process of obtaining a warrant. And so
right.
This is the combination of police and a judge and the basis to issue such a warrant. But
she said they didn't serve her with a warrant yesterday or before it happened.
They didn't serve me. They didn't protect me.
They didn't care about me.
No, she's not talking about a warrant. They didn't protect and serve. If you watch the video, if they have copies of the warrant, they go over it in the squad car when they start to question, maybe we do have the wrong place. And maybe this, maybe the basis of this warrant was a little hanky, too. You hear an interchange between two of the officers. But the issue is 2 years, the failure to proactively resolve, remedy the wrong. That is unacceptable. And where's COPA? And where is Lori Lightfoot, who, as Anjanette Young said, you know, built her bona fides, her candidacy on being a police reformer? You know, Miss Consent Decree, Lori Lightfoot, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This will shake the confidence of people in police, number one, obviously, because the police are demagogued all the time, part of the racial politics of the city. Right. But this is a legitimate problem. Number two, it should shake the confidence of everyone in the city about this administration, just as the last administration, Trayvon Martin, just as the last administration, just as the last administration, just as the administration before that, go back 100 and I don't know. Well, go back to 1839 as far as I'm concerned, but you know, go back for the last 50 years at minimum. I mean, did you ever get exposed to these stories and say, boy, we have to do something completely different in Chicago? And I think some people, perhaps even Anjanette Young, thought they were doing something completely different with Lori Lightfoot. And what do you think now? You weren't.
Well, Young's attorney said the city, you know, as you mentioned, they blocked them, the client, from obtaining the body cam video. They said, quote, the reason they say they denied the FOIA request is because there was an ongoing investigation. This isn't about a protective order. It's about a cover-up.
Well, I mean, whatever. That's the, you know, the plaintiff's attorney's bloviations. The bottom line is they were not forthcoming. Oh. It did take going to federal court. Well, the city went to federal court to try to stop CBS from running with the video.
That's when you know you have a story.
Well, also, this again, 2 years removed.
Yeah.
People from FOP to the administrative leadership of the Chicago Police Department to the political civilian leadership of the city. It's a failure all the way around as far as I'm concerned. Failure all the way around, isn't it? I mean, there's no justification for how Anjanette Young was treated because a mistake was made. Even worse than that to me is the lack of accountability, because it says to Anjanette Young that they actually aren't interested in protecting and serving. I don't think that's true of the Chicago police, but that's what the lack of remedying a wrong does. Where is it? Where's anybody other than after the fact, conveniently, you know, heaping moral scorn and, you know, getting in front of the camera to shake your fist and show how outraged you are and say this could never happen again and then just move on to the next thing? Because that's what Lori Lightfoot's doing. Isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean,
what else is she supposed to say?
She's supposed to explain why it's 2 years. She's supposed to explain. Where is COPA? What has COPA done? Apparently not much. Oh, are they going to tell me? Oh, they've had a hard time getting interviews with the officers on the scene. Lame. No. FOP, too. FOP should make those officers available. Yeah, have your legal representation. Those officers themselves should stand up and say, you know, we made a mistake and we got to do right by Anjanette Young. Does anybody ever say that in Chicago? In Illinois? Does anybody ever say in this city and this godforsaken state, we did wrong by somebody in whom she or he placed their trust and we're going to make it right? And I don't need Dave Savini and I don't need plaintiff's attorneys to force me to do the right thing. Has that ever happened? Can you recall an instance?
No, never.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, James Monroe had nothing on Joe Biden and company, huh? The era of good feelings, 21st century version. Putting the partisan sniping behind those sincere calls for unity and great ambassadors for the left in 2020 America, like Georgia Democrat Senate candidate, the good Reverend, the pro-choice Reverend, Ralph Warnock.
While others were sleeping, members of the United States Senate declared war and launched a vicious and evil attack on the most vulnerable people in America. Herod is on the loose. Herod is a cynical politician who's willing to kill children and kill the children's health program in order to preserve his own wealth and his own power. Hope is in the air, but Herod is on the loose. The hopes and the fears of all the years have met in thee tonight. And so on Friday night, the United States Senate decided by a slim majority to pick the pockets of the poor, the sick, the old, and the yet unborn in order to line the pockets of the ultra-rich. Don't tell me about gangsters and thugs on the streets. There are more gangsters and thugs in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol, than there are.
Yeah, that was the good Reverend back in 2017 on the occasion of Senate passing the Trump tax cuts. So just so you understand, passing tax cuts is killing children, but advocating for the actual killing of children, as Reverend Warnock does, is not killing children. You got that? This, among many of his pronouncements, anybody who voted for tax cuts is a veritable King Herod murdering children to get to the Christ child. That's the biblical comparison from this very unbiblical pastor running for Senate in Georgia. And you combine that with Biden campaign manager Jen O'Malley Dixon's characterization of Republicans, and boy, you really have, as I said, this era of good feelings taking hold.
Well, she gave this interview in Glamour magazine. I'm sure you read it, right, Dan? You're all over that. They were talking about redefining of compromise. And she said, frankly, you know, yes, that needs a president-elect was able to connect with people over this sense of unity in the primary. People would mock him like, you think you can work with Republicans? I'm not saying that they're not a bunch of blankers.
Frackers,
yes. Mitch McConnell is terrible. But this sense that you couldn't wish for that, you couldn't wish for this bipartisanship ideal. I mean, basically, she called GOPers the F word right after promoting unity.
That was
in the same breath, Dan.
Very much akin to Joe Biden's speech after the Electoral College votes were cast on Monday. So, you know, it's been, by the way, great interview at Glamour magazine.
Oh, yeah.
I read that right after I read that piece, 10 Ways to Be a Better Listener. So excellent. Excellent issue of Glamour magazine.
It was a piece on politics, motherhood, and doing hard things.
For more on all of this in advance of, definitely a watershed moment in American political history and for the next 2 years, the January 5th Georgia Senate runoffs, pleased to be joined again by Roger Kimball, editor of the New Criterion. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. I have to confess that my subscription to Glamour lapsed some time ago, so I may not be
well-informed. I'll tell you what, sir. Christmas is right around the corner, and I'm going to gift you a subscription. How about that? So we can compare how we do on the quizzes.
I'll give you my address afterwards.
Yeah.
But I hope you still have your Vogue thing.
Roger.
I was once a commissioner to write a piece for Vogue magazine many years ago.
Oh.
And I was not intimately familiar with it. So I was supposed to write about the architectural critic Paul Goldberg, who was then the chief architectural critic for the New York Times. And so doing my homework, I went and purchased a copy of Vogue and opened it up to the masthead. And, eventually down toward the bottom was my editor, who was listed as a senior editor. But right in the middle, on the line by itself, in bold type, was somebody whose exalted position was shoe editor.
Yes.
I felt yeah. that was...
Those were the Anna Wintour years in Roger Kimball's career, as I recall them, right, Roger?
Yeah, they never published the piece on that, so I'm still that's an accolade that I have yet to add to my quiver as a piece in Vogue. Now.
Well,
I have a feeling that's going to be an unrealized ambition.
But, no, I don't.
But
think
I,
so.
I will.
At least you tried.
There's no reason for that to be the case, actually, Roger, man of letters such as yourself. There's a ready-made piece to be written for Vogue, and that is a review of Hunter Biden's forthcoming art exhibition. So there you go. You can check that box.
I did see that. I was my quota for absurdity was full up yesterday, so I decided to put that on the docket for today.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's refill that bucket of absurdity and talk a little bit about Raphael Warnock and that Georgia Senate runoff. I mean, the extremism piece of it set aside, the incredible things that he has said over the years and continues to say, notwithstanding, what does it say about where we're at that someone as intolerant and hateful and extreme as Raphael Warnock could be in a statistical dead heat for a Senate seat in Georgia?
Yeah, well, it doesn't say anything good, does it? I mean, it's, just listening to him pontificate before the show, it was, he's a demagogue right out of the pages of, the 20th century and some of the bad moments thereof. He, this call for unity and so on, it reminded me a little bit of a passage in 1984 when Winston is sitting in his apartment and Orwell introduces a little telescreen, and from the telescreen comes words like unity, love, mm-hmm. patriotism, so on. And it sounded exactly like a tweet that was emitted by Kamala Harris a week or two ago. Exactly the same words. It was remarkable. And of course, the what we're seeing now is the blatant issuance of a contradiction. They call for unity, even as their policies are incredibly divisive and destructive. The person who said, I can't remember whether it was Mencken or P.T. Barnum, that no one ever went broke by underestimating the stupidity of the American public. This is a test of that. We are at an important crossroads in this country. And, I fear not to be melodramatic about it, but I fear that the last free and fair election was 2016. This election, in my view, was rigged, and the rigging was successful. They managed to steal the election by stealing votes in five or six cities across the country. And I find it amazing to watch even people on the Republican side acceding to this theft, saying, well, it was an election, the people spoke. This is not true. This was a totally manufactured election.
Well, in what way, Roger? I mean, how?
Well, in the following way. The big thing, the huge thing, were the absentee ballots. Usually they're about 5 or 6% of the vote. This time it was 60%.
Wow.
This under the cover of COVID, this was an invitation to ballot stuffing. tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of ballots were prepared before the election. And you didn't request them. They just sent these ballots out. So it's just a positive invitation to ballot stuffing. And across the country, why was it that at almost the exact same moment in five or six cities, the counting stopped? The counting stopped. Why was that? And then it starts up again, and there are these gigantic spikes for Joe Biden. How is that? Statistically, it is not only anomalous, it is impossible. And then, of course, there are the voting machines. You know, I don't think we've gotten the final word on these Dominion voting machines, which do have a Chinese component and so on. It sounds paranoid. It sounds like something out of a thriller novel. But Delmore Schwartz once said, even paranoids have enemies. And it seems to me that this election is allowed to, you know, if we just say, well, we'll live with it. It's the process we have to. This will have been the last election. That's, you know, the country lasted for a long time, 233 years. It's a pretty good run. But
it's time to wrap it up. That's a wrap.
Having been done once, it will be done again and again. And of course, should Mr. Warnock and his fellow Democrat be elected in Georgia, that will really be it, because then the Democrats, for at least 2 years, will have all three branches of government. You'll see the court will be packed. You know, we'll not nine justices, but maybe 13 or 25 or who knows. It statehood for D.C. and so on is on the docket. You know, it will be a long list of prescriptions that will thrill the Chinese and will definitely harm the people of the United States.
Assuming something of a game-changing variety does not occur between now and Jan 6th and between now and Jan 20th, what would your advice and counsel to President Trump be going forward into 2021 and the 2022 cycle, which starts right away, and 2024, how should he position himself if he wants to maintain relevance and influence in the policy discussion within Republican ranks at minimum?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, he has a very compelling agenda. The Make America Great agenda is a great agenda. And he was able to do an extraordinary amount in 4 years. You know, I needn't rehearse it. It's everybody who's paying attention understands what incredible accomplishments he made. And I think that is an agenda that resonates with a huge part of the population. I mean, you know, 74 million people voted for him. It's extraordinary. I think he wants to keep being the apostle of that agenda. He wants to do what he can to keep it alive, and it will be a resistance movement. Should he run in 2024? I don't know. He will be, you know, as old as Joe Biden then. I don't know. That's for another day. But certainly, it would be of the first order of business to retake the House in 2022, which I think most observers think that's quite likely. And let's hope to expand the Republican majority in the Senate if we manage to hold on to it in January. You know, one thing I regret to say that I think that Mr. Warnock might have been right about is the level of corruption in government. That's it's hard for us to take that on board. We like to think of our public servants as being just that, public servants. Unfortunately, many, many are not. And it's not just on the Democratic side, which is something that's a little hard to absorb, but I think it's true. But let's just start with on the Democratic side and talk about Eric Swalwell. How can a man who has been compromised by an intimate relation with a Chinese spy be on the House Intel Committee?
I know.
How is that possible? It's just extraordinary.
Roger Kimball, editor of the New Criterion and perhaps forthcoming contributor to Vogue magazine. We'll see. Roger Kimball,
pulling for you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Bye, guys.
Bye. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it.
It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning and welcome back to the show. And we're pleased now to be joined by Bob Woodson. He is a friend of the show, founder and president of the Woodson Center, also founder of 1776 Unites, alternative vision for an understanding of American history as compared to that presented by the 1619 Project. He's got a new book, does Bob Woodson, Lessons from the Least of These, The Woodson Principles. Bob Woodson, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Pleased to be here, Dan. Good talking to you.
Yeah, I'm excited about your new book. And the place I want to start, because we spend a lot of time talking about groups and monoliths as monolithic, unfortunately. It's just sort of handles we use, but it belies complications, the black, white, middle income, lower income, and so on and so forth. And your book and some discussions of it that I've read, you break down sort of three categories of people who are living in poverty, which has been your life's work of trying to uplift people of all races out of poverty. And I wanted you to break that down because I think that needs to be broken down so we can have that sort of textured conversation about it that's required.
Yeah, I was testifying before the Senate, and this came up. And what happens is that when people are talking about the poor, they tend to generalize as if everybody is poor for the same reason. But you can't generalize about any group, black, white, or poor. Neither can you the poor. And so I've identified three categories. Category one are people whose character is intact. They have the right values. They're doing it the right way. But external circumstance changes. Death of a breadwinner, a factory moves out of town, and they lose their job. For them, they use temporary assistance the way it was intended, as an ambulance service, not as a transportation system. So they stay on welfare for a limited period. Then they go on. Category two are people who also have good character, but they look at perverse incentives when they do receive aid. If they get a raise, they can lose the benefits that they need. And so they decide to stay on the dole. And if you just remove the perverse incentives, they will be fine. But the category three, the ones that concern most of us, because these are the people who are poor because of the a crisis in values and culture. For them, when they're drug addicts or they're engaging in self-destructive behavior because of the poor attitudes or values, for them, giving the same kind of aid that you do for the first two injures them with the helping hand. And so that third category, they must be transformed and redeemed and having that attitude change, overhaul, and then opportunity works. Well, the Woodson Centers, we specialize in category three. And so we've been successful in that. The problem is when we're debating remedies, people on the left tend to look at all poor as if they're category one. And people on the right tend to think all poor people are category three. So we miss one another when we're talking about remedies.
And so to talk about some of the principles to deal with category three, since categories one and two are sort of, as you say, they're sort of starting from the right foundation, so with a little bit of short-term help, they're going to get to where they need to be independent and successful on their own terms. But Category 3 presents all sorts of challenges.
These are the people who are filling welfare roles, going to jail, who are of concern to most people. That's the category, and we specialize in that. Our groups throughout the country have demonstrated and that how to do that. And so what I've done in this book over the course of 40 years of walking with these grassroots healing agents, I call them, I have learned by observing how they promote redemption and transformation in people. And first of all, they have the highest expectation of people. And they're also very transparent. They go up to someone who's a drug addict and say, listen, I have been where you are. Let me take you by the hand and show you the steps that I have taken to become sober. Let me take you to the chapel. Let me take you here. Let me walk with you for a while. And as a consequence, they are enticed into a process of healing themselves. And these grassroots leaders tend not to be certified professionals. They tend to be, as I've said in the book, they have letters in front of their names, not behind them. something.
And so, thinking about sort of the basis from which you start in addressing poverty and by extension, opportunity, success, how do you look at the identitarian obsession that has now been scaled to probably the White House? And we see this playing out in real time with Joe Biden's cabinet selections and the arguments from different groups based on race or sexual orientation, gender, the arguments that are occurring over how many Pacific Islanders do you have versus how many blacks versus how many Asians versus how many women versus how many LGBTQ?
It is the most destructive to the interests of poor people that I can ever imagine. That's why when I set up 1776, our goal is to deracialize race and desegregate poverty. I find it interesting that white guilt has become the new source of racism and also a source of black power. Critical race theory is a fancy name for stereotyping. We used to call it stereotyping, you know? All blacks look alike, talk alike. And the old racists used to say, well, blacks are shiftless, lazy, unreliable people. And critical race theory says the same thing, that all blacks, all women are the same. They're this, and therefore they all share this in common. It's the same thing. Critical race theory is stereotyping on steroids.
Well, then what did you would think when Joe Biden, then candidate Joe Biden, said, if you vote for Trump, you ain't black?
I mean, it's insulting. And yet this is what I mean. It's kind of he's ushering a new kind of racial McCarthyism that some have. But I'm amazed that there wasn't more of an outrage. It's almost as if the black left has almost abandoned any concern about the rich legacy of the civil rights movement, that somehow he can say that and still enjoy their vote, is just short of amazing to me. Just amazing.
And this story out of it's sort of not particular to a state, but the Episcopal Diocese of Texas acknowledging that its first bishop in 1859 was a slaveholder. And so you have these, for example, Minnesota Council Churches cites a host of injustices from mid-19th century atrocities against Native Americans to police killings of black people. In the first of its kind Truth and Reparations Initiative, engaging 25 member denominations, what you have now is these ideologically left churches around the country are now pursuing what has been advocated for by leftist politicians professional agitators like Black Lives Matter. The churches themselves are taking up the idea that they're going to take up collections for reparations, I guess, for the black members of their churches.
It is most insulting. I mean, it's not only that. One bar owner gave all blacks 20% off drinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but it also misses, too, is that slavery was evil, but Native Americans, the five civilized tribes, on that Trail of Tears, they took 5,000 slaves with them. So somehow portraying Native American people as the question is, and also there were blacks who owned slaves. And so the issue is a lot more complicated than that. But this whole move towards reparations is really taken on a life of its own. But the people who are being injured most will be low-income people. It's kind of like a racial poverty program. The $22 trillion that America spent over the last 60 years on poverty programs, 70% of it went not to the poor, but those who served the poor. Any money from reparations will not get down to those in those low-income communities. It'll be a middle-class kind of entitlement program that all of these race grievance counselors will prosper. This is what we're trying to do. The sleeping giant in America, Dan, are the thousands and millions of low-income people who are being pimped. And they're being scammed by middle-class people who are conspiring with the radical white left. In fact, the radical white left has taken over the civil rights movement. They are merely pawns of the radical left.
Well, I saw some. I'm sorry. That's what you say. You know, the problem is in America today is not a racism so much as it is elitism. So, how do you break that? Is it you know, if there's a particular public policy, some have argued, including Attorney General Bill Barr, more globally, that essentially school choice, you have to break the government monopoly, the government school monopoly, in order to break some of these cultural disparities that you're describing, like that are a function of elitism.
But you see, but we didn't get here by having a policy. Black Lives Matter and critical race theory started as an exotic discussion on campus, and then it leaked into the mainstream of America. And so social institutions began to congeal around that false narrative. Well, I think Light Matter, what we're doing at the Woodson Center is organizing thousands of black mothers who lost children to urban violence. And also thousands of grassroots people. In other words, the way that you have to confront all of these race grievances is because they derive their moral authority by being the so-called legitimate spokesperson of the poor. Well, if thousands of low-income black people stand up and say they do not represent us, in fact, what they're proposing by defunding the police is having the consequence of destroying our children. And so what we're doing at the Woodson Center is we are, within a few weeks, we'll be announcing a major campaign, and we are partnering with these mothers and helping them to, and there'll be other groups. There's got to be a rebellion on the part of low-income blacks to say they're tired of being exploited by these middle-class elites who are engaging in a kind of bait and switch game where they use the conditions of violence and despair, unemployment, and the so-called disparities being visited upon low-income blacks, and they're using it to generate income for themselves that will only benefit them and not the people in whose name it's being demanded. And so it has to be a moral brush fire, has to burn from within. And that's what we're trying to excite now.
Well, that's the observation of Ludwig von Mises. He wants to improve conditions, must propagate a new mentality, not merely a new institution. And that seems to me is what you're attempting to do, the really heavy lifting of propagating a new mentality. Bob Woodson, founder and president of the Woodson Center, the new book, Lessons from the Least of These, The Woodson Principles. Pick it up. Bob, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
And thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We discussed this topic a little bit earlier in the week, on Monday, actually, to accompany the delivery of the first batch of Pfizer vaccines around the country, to hospitals around the country. Should the federal government think about paying people to take the vaccine to overcome skepticism wherever it resides so as to get to the percentage of the American public that needs to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity as quick as possible. There's many economists of some renown who argue that that makes some sense. Jason Riley wrote a piece about it in the Wall Street Journal last week, and he also referenced a study that was done in 2015 by economists at Swarthmore College, finding that offering people a $30 reward was enough to increase vaccination rates by 12 percentage points. But it's not without its detractors, the idea. Oh, and by the way, maybe part of it is paying people on the administration side, not the reception side. New York State has only done 4,000 so far. I mean, I know we're early on, 48 hours, but they were 80,000 doses distributed to hospitals around the country, including New York City, and they're less than 10% of the way home. I don't know. By the way, we also find out that the vials in which the Pfizer vaccines were shipped, some of them actually have more doses than advertised. They have a sixth and a seventh dose, not the five doses. So you actually have more supply in some areas than you initially thought you were going to get per how it actually works in practice, just sort of an interesting wrinkle. So the question is, getting back to the overarching question, because you have 25 to a third of the population saying they're not really interested in the vaccine, should we pay to address at least some of those skeptics and get them over their resistance to being vaccinated? To help us explore that question, we're pleased to be joined by two law professors from St. Louis University, Anna Santos Rushman, assistant professor of law at St. Louis U, a Billiken, with Robert Gator, professor of law at St. Louis University, also a Billiken.
Billiken. Oh, come on, Daniel. That was my thunder.
professors, counselors, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having
us.
So you know of some of the economists that promote this idea and politicians of anywhere between $30 and $1,500 to take the vaccine, including some with a Nobel laureate in their resume and a Nobel Prize in their resume. And but you both penned a piece suggesting there are some concerns why maybe paying people to take the vaccine is not a good idea. Why don't you raise those concerns?
Anna, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, I can get us started. So we have several types of concerns, but the overriding one is that we actually think the plan will backfire if we attempt to pay people to get the vaccine. So you're talking about the federal government at the time in our history in which there is profound distrust of the agencies and also the people who were in charge of the coronavirus response. If you marry that with the idea that even before the pandemic, levels of distrust of vaccines were going through the roof, we think that's just an explosive combination and that the payment will be perceived actually as increasing risk perceptions of the vaccine as opposed to calming people down and making them understand that although the vaccine was indeed developed really, really quickly, it is safe and we think effective. So we think it will backfire because people will see that as an expression of heightened risk to the point that the federal government is now intervening and doing something it has never done before and offering people money in exchange for vaccination. So this is our first concern with the proposal.
Professor Gator.
Yeah, so there's additional concerns too. You know, $1,000, that's the figure that we were using because that's what was first suggested, as you mentioned, Dan, there's the range. But $1,000 has a different effect on different people. And so those who were more concerned about individuals who feel like, well, that makes a difference to me, so I'm going to take a risk that I normally wouldn't want to take because that amount of money makes so much of a difference to my home budget, whereas someone who's wealthier can afford to sit back and say, no, I think I won't. I'll just rely, if there's going to be herd immunity, I'll rely on others. And so there's sort of a free riding aspect and a bit of preying on the lack of wealth of a certain segment of the population.
But if you have a family of four, I mean, that could be some real money.
Yeah, that's right. It's not nothing. Although to some people, it might not seem worth it with respect to the risk, especially as Anna was pointing out,
our concern about the money itself signaling that there's more risk that people don't really know about. And, you know, you have to think about this not just from there's different groups of people who can be skeptical of the safety of the vaccine. There's sort of a group of individuals who are anti-vaccination across the board. They're skeptical of all vaccines. But there's others, too. You know, there's individuals who were not anti-vax prior to the development of this vaccine, and they aren't necessarily now, but they are concerned that this was so rushed, you know, warp speed. We've never seen a vaccine developed this quickly before, and here it's being rolled out in mass doses. And so just the mere fact that it was rushed makes them concerned that there's just things we don't know about this vaccine and as a member of the general public. And then there's individuals who have a history of being abused as part of clinical research. And for all those groups of people, you have to take into account what's going to be the effect of a financial reward if you're putting it out there. And there's at least some behavioral data showing that if you put money out there for taking on health risks associated with, say, participating in a human medical trial, that the primary effect is that it signals that there is unaccounted for risk, that this is a highly risky venture. Why else would I be paid this amount of money to participate?
Well, but I mean, but there's another category of people. And by the way, that Swarthmore study from 2015 sort of speaks to that in part. But let me posit some other cohort of individuals. People that say, I'm not anti-vax, but I'm not real motivated to go get the vaccine either. Now, you give me $1,000, maybe it gets me over the hump. I mean, we pay people to give blood. We pay people to go to sperm banks, not to get too graphic here.
Well,
but
that's true.
But I mean, but the bottom line is,
donate,
you know,
hair.
It's not that I'm not afraid of giving blood, but I'm not going to make it a priority. But unless you make it worth my while, and so why not this?
Well, if I could just weigh in, it is absolutely true that sometimes financial rewards and connection with health behaviors do work, and we recognize that, and we also recognize that, I know you want to talk about more people who are fighting some form of inertia, but we recognize that for lower-income individuals, this could be important. I think that primarily we're concerned about two things. The first one is the precedent it sets in the particular case of vaccination, and second is the instrumentalization of it. So in terms of setting a precedent, typically the federal government does not pay for health-related behaviors that are needed at a massive scale in the context of a pandemic, and we don't think that we should make vaccination dependent on financial incentives. But more important than that is that if we do in this particular context, the more likely outcome is that that particular measure will be weaponized, as a lot of vaccine-related measures are. And what we mean by that is that we've seen misinformation on vaccines, and this is not strictly with just your traditional anti-vaccine community. This is also with the help of external powers, for instance, that just have an interest in getting America to become increasingly more divisive, and they've discovered vaccines are a divisive topic. So we've seen all of this increase throughout the pandemic. At the current rates that we're seeing during the pandemic, anti-vaccine discourses are going to be predominant online in just about 10 years. And in this particular environment, in the specific context of vaccines, having the federal government step in, the federal government doesn't even have the legal ability to have a national mandate in place, for instance. That's something that falls to the states. So if you have the federal government take this type of step, we truly believe, and there are studies supporting the expansion of this type of instrumentalization of vaccine discourses, we truly believe that what's going to happen is that the anti-vaccine, not the communities per se and people who have legitimate doubts about vaccines, but people making money off of vaccine misinformation circulating online, or people with an interest in spreading further doubts about vaccines, either for health-related reasons or for political reasons or for social reasons or other purposes, they will take advantage of that. So we are concerned about the differential the treatment of low-income versus non-low-income individuals, but we think the primary result is actually going to be short-term. There will be a spike in anti-vaccine discourses instrumentalized by this, and in long-term, we're going to undermine vaccine confidence because a lot of the discourse that you will see will be questioning the safety and efficacy of the vaccine because it's now attached to the financial reward. And frankly, that's something we don't need right now. When even pre-pandemic, we were already struggling with vaccine trust, and not just in the U.S., but, you know, for our purposes in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit hard to zero in on exactly what that increment is of skepticism or activity or politicization, because that's going to occur regardless, as you say. And then you have the combination of stories that come out, like the story that four individuals in the Pfizer trial had a temporary facial paralysis, Bell's palsy, taking the vaccine. Now, it was temporary, and they're fine, and that's part of the context, too, and we should be transparent about these things. But, of course, you know, anything like that says, well, I don't need to take the risk of getting, you know, partial facial paralysis even temporarily, so I'll just wait and see how this plays out. And, you know, so that's a real dynamic, too. So, you know, once you start having conversations about trade-offs and risk and consequences, it inevitably brings in political actors, whether there's a financial incentive or not.
I think one of the things we also have to – it's so hard during a pandemic and during a public health emergency to focus in on health in ways we're not used to. And I think it's helpful if you try to imagine the entire population of the country as sort of one body that is partially infected, and we're trying to control that infection. So one of the concerns is, while with some people it might a financial incentive might not have a problematic effect, or it might have nothing more than just deciding to motivate them a little bit. If for others instead it creates mistrust, then you have to sort of look at that body overall and say, have we actually disincentivized more than we have incentivized? Have we created mistrust? And if so, how long does that mistrust last compared to the little bit of extra inertia? So it's sort of looking for that net gain so as to achieve herd immunity. And it's hard to know where herd immunity is going to be. Let's say it's 70-75% of the population being vaccinated. We were already under that before the vaccine came out. We drifted farther below that in terms of just polls of who's willing to take the vaccine. If we roll out a financial incentive, and while it incentivizes some and then disincentivizes others who might have participated, who might have been sitting on the fence, and they watch a few frontline workers get theirs and decide, okay, I think I'll do it. But now we've disincentivized by sending them a signal that there's additional risk here. Why would we, for the first time ever as a country, pay significant amounts of money? Then we might see that we sort of lock ourselves in at a level of vaccination across the whole country that doesn't get us to herd immunity, and that the body of the country as itself just simply doesn't benefit from this vaccination rollout.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why we're at least concerned about going cautiously here.
No, I mean, what's the net-net? I think that's the right question, no question. Anna Santos-Rushman, she's an assistant professor of law at St. Louis University with Robert Goddard, professor of law at St. Louis University as well. Their piece, Why Paying People to Get the Coronavirus Vaccine Won't Work. Professors, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And they both joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and China has been, continues to be the hot national security topic for all kinds of reasons, not just related to Eric Swalwell's girlfriend, but also as people pore over that data dump earlier in the week of some 2 to 3 million members of the Chinese Communist Party in good standing that were Chinese assets around the world, including in America, and getting a sense of just exactly how embedded Chinese operatives are, engaged in both industrial espionage and intellectual property piracy, but also, of course, with respect to politicians compromising American politicians, both at the local as well as federal level. For more on this topic and all things related to the Chinese communist threat, we're pleased to be joined by Dana Chang, senior editor of China News for the Epoch Times. Dana, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
So this data leak that apparently was actionable for Hong Kong dissidents for some time before it made its way to the West and was reported by Sky News in Australia earlier in the week. How much faith should we place in the names and the ranks and the serial numbers, as it were, all of these Chinese communist assets deployed around the world to do the bidding of the Chinese government? Is that really a watershed moment in trying to stop China's advance on its mission of being the world superpower?
I think the data and the number of Communist Party member around the world, this data is a tip of an iceberg. And we all know among Chinese, many people coming to United States and going to Europe and Australia, many of them are Communist Party. They have family members and they have a business and they have strong tie with Communist Party. And since they are members, they are still loyal to the Communist Party. So if the Communist Party needs, they will serve the party. I don't mean every party member is like that. I don't mean every Chinese, but there are a lot that have been strategically placed at critical and information-sensitive positions in these companies and the government organizations. Let me give an example. Around year 2001, I was talking with a think tank director in D.C., and she told me that they did a survey. Within a very short period of time, many Congress offices on the Hill, either the lead staff director of the staff or congressman or someone that play key role on the Hill, they suddenly start to have a Chinese girlfriend, and they did a survey to about more than 200 of them. So it's not just one case. And then at the same time, and you see news that CEOs of major corporations get divorced and marry a 30-year younger Chinese wife. So, and these are not a coincidence. It's strategically planned. But later on, that's about 20 years ago. And later on, China get more business and money. So it's a woman plus money. And it had corrupted a lot of people.
And with respect to the Hunter Biden piece of this story, as it continues to develop and more emails come out of his communications with the chairman, former chairman of the CEFC, that huge communist Chinese-backed energy company, and others, the partnerships, the joint ventures, and so forth.
It's typical.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I mean. It should not be surprising to us that because that's China's MO. It just should be a warning to us as how high they can get, how quickly to compromise people.
Exactly. For them, it's more economic. It's cheaper to corrupt high level officials than conquer a whole country. China, the Communist Party, CCP, has always seen America as the number one enemy. And their goal is to overtake America and become the world leader. Because the communists always see the free world as a threat. And America is the leader of the free world. So for them, and this is the strategy they use globally, even in Africa, they get the children of those African leaders to China to the Chinese university and give them scholars, give them girls as companion, and make sure they are pro-Beijing, pro-CCP. Here, it's the same. I have heard from like diplomats I know, when they go to China and they know that hotel rooms are monitored, the high-end hotel, those hotel rooms are monitored. So in the evening, there are women trying to get into those rooms. Even if you lock your door and you know, try to resist that kind of arrangement, you wake up next morning without knowing a naked woman can be lying beside you. It's all on camera.
Oh, for blackmail purposes?
Well, that's the excuse I always use.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the way
communist.
To close the deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, no,
Dan,
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, I mean, do you think, since they want to take over, you know, the world, China does, do you think that they secretly released this, the COVID-19 to try and conquer? I mean, because we're brought to our knees right now. Kids aren't in school, so we'll be the dumbest generation that group will be. And our economy is on its knees right now.
Well, how they planned that, I don't know the detail, but at least, they didn't stop the traveling to other country while they stopped the nationwide traveling, nationwide commute. They didn't stop. And that's purposeful. Now, I give you an example. You know, Taiwan, through hard negotiation, tried to ship Taiwanese from Wuhan back to Taiwan. And they have an agreed list. The last minute, they put three people extra on the same plane, and they were all infected people purposefully.
And with respect to the situation with COVID in China right now, there's a lot of, not surprisingly, conflicting stories. There's a suggestion that they have developed sort of five different vaccines, and they're already exporting them to countries that over which they want to have some influence, including in South America, like Brazil. There's the suggestion that's been made by Chinese nationals that I've heard, even coming from the Hill to staffers on the Hill, that actually they had the vaccine. They had a vaccine back in September, and that Beijing has zero, like hard number, round egg, zero COVID cases. What is your handle on the reality of COVID-19 in China at this point, including the efficacy of any vaccine they've developed?
Well, they are certainly competing with U.S. and the West in developing vaccine. I don't think they are so advanced, because we heard that people traveling from China who have taken the vaccine and travel to Africa and other countries, they were tested positive. So if everything reported just directly from China, you can believe that it's the CCP media. And the goal of the CCP media is to control and to lie. The reason the COVID got reported is because people travel from China to other countries, and it's discovered in other countries.
And so, I hear what you're saying. So they're sort of offloading any discernible cases to continue the facade of having no cases, having defeated COVID, and so forth. With respect to your piece, and you talk, I grew up in communist China, here's my warning to America. I mean, there are so many related to the Chinese communists, but what is the overriding message that you want Americans to understand about the perspective of the Chinese communists in charge of that country?
Oh, I think America see China as different from like Soviet Union. Soviet Union, and people say that's a communist, but China cloned the whole system from Soviet Union. It control people's, it control media, control people's words. It try to take individual rights from people. It try to incite hatred. It use one group against another group. And it tried to stop people from, believing in their Buddhas and Taos. Those are the fundamental foundation of the society, is moral foundation. Communists would destroy them all. and national heritage and the culture. Communists were destroyed all. Recently, what I've seen in America is more and more is similar to what I have seen when I was growing up in China. And that's very sad. We immigrated here. We came here because of the freedom here. And it's very, very sad to see that.
Dana Chang, Senior Editor of China News for the Epoch Times. Dana, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, Charlie. Neighborhood of make-believe.
All aboard. We're going to the neighborhood of make-believe.
Yay.
Yeah, we're going to go see King Friday and his transportation secretary, Pete Buttigieg.
I've also had a personal love of transportation ever since childhood. More than once, as a college student, I would convince a friend to travel nearly 1,000 miles back to Indiana with me on Amtrak. Though I know that in this administration, I will at best aspire to be the second biggest train enthusiast around.
I love the choo-choo.
I spent a spring break in graduate school aboard a cargo ship studying there. Travel in my mind is synonymous with growth, with adventure, even love, so much so that I proposed to my husband, Chasten, in an airport terminal. So don't let anybody tell you that O'Hare isn't romantic.
Barf.
I faced a constant battle with that natural enemy of all mayors, the pothole.
So he's Walter Mitty who fills potholes. He's qualified to be a transportation secretary. Meow, 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 in the land neighborhood of make-believe.
Thanks.
What in the hell?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.